So what I've done is I have developed in each of the grades that I teach science in the grammar school what I call science statements. And science statements are the facts and the rules, the laws that would be helpful for students to learn in the grammar stage, playing off of Dorothy Sayers' belief that this is a wonderful time for students to be memorizing because their memory, their ability to memorize is very strong, as well as their ability to observe. Now, I was in Mr. Smith's class earlier and heard him say that we failed our students in some ways earlier in this classical movement by just requiring them to memorize. And I don't want to leave you with the impression that these science statements that I'm creating are all there is, that the students are just required to memorize these statements and that's all they do day after day. That's not what happens. What happens is we have science statements that we learn each quarter of the year in earth science, in physics, in biology, and in chemistry. And it begins in third grade and it goes through sixth grade. These statements build on one another. And they particularly build in areas like chemistry and physics, where it's easier to build because that's what those subjects generally do. And by learning these statements, these important facts in each of these areas, the students are learning the language of science. So an example would be something that I would teach a third grade student would be an element is a pure substance that cannot be broken down chemically into any simpler pure substance. Okay, that's something that they'll need to know when they're in 11th grade chemistry class. And we don't want them learning that for the first time in 11th grade chemistry when they can memorize so easily in the younger years. Now, in the third grade, they basically memorize what an element is. But as they get farther up into the grammar school, we look at the periodic table. We talk about the difference between the elements. We illustrate the elements. I mean, they're able to see in class elements. We talk about Mendeleev and the way that he came to the periodic table by understanding the relationships between periodic occurrences of certain properties. So we get these kids analyzing and thinking drawing conclusions in the grammar school, but we start off by first teaching them the language of science. What's nice about these statements is that it makes it very easy to review, and it makes it very easy to review science from year to year because you have encapsulated some very important facts and rules about science, and therefore if you have different teachers teaching different grades, all you do is transfer the statements from one year to the next, up a grade, and then they review what the students have learned in prior years. We will put these statements to song and to sound off or to echoes, all kinds of ways. We use hand motions in the younger grades, all kinds of ways to teach these students the language of science. We also teach them the language of research. So we have special statements that we use that define independent and dependent variables and constants and those kinds of terminology that are involved in research. But we don't leave it there. The second tool that I want to talk about is that the students every year from third grade through sixth do their own original science research. And I think that's an extremely important tool for bridging the gap between the grammar school and the dialectic and the rhetoric schools. The students are required to come up with their own scientific question, design their own experiment, conduct that experiment, make the observations as they're conducting it, record those observations, and then interpret their results, and write a scientific research paper, as well as orally defend their paper. So you can see that we're trying to ground them very well in the language of science, the terminology, the important facts and rules, which we would emphasize in other ways with hands-on science or trips to the insect house or whatever, insect collections along the way. And then, based on that good foundation that they have of science, they're then able to execute their own original research and write about it, which is very important, and be able to orally defend it using their science background.
All right, I would say... I chose a couple different tools that I use other than kind of the standard, and I would probably just preface this by saying the Seven Laws by Milton, and I know that in the various conventions and so forth, a lot is spoken of. I have my own little copy that I keep in my notebook at school, and I continually go over that, and I try to make those just part of my being as a teacher. They're wonderful, and the more I study Milton, the more I see the tremendous wisdom that he possessed. So I recommend that. All of those are tremendous things. If you're not familiar with the Seven Laws, there would be books here and plenty of information there. So I'm not going to go into that. I'm going to give you a couple other things, assuming that you're somewhat familiar with that. The first thing I would say is one of the things that I do for review, the various subjects, and give them a little plug for the Pro Gym stuff that I did earlier, where we're trying to encourage children to communicate the things that they're learning in their own words. Of course, that involves a lot of the facts that we're learning. But one way that you can do that, of course, a lot of my review is just using what I call a catechetical method, where I'm giving the prompts with the questions. Or if they get stuck in something, I'll give them the question. And usually that'll help to trigger the answer. So I'll just ask them a variety of questions. If we're doing a math review, I start right up and say, what do you know about this? If I've taught them something the day before, tell me what you learned about lines. Somebody tell me one thing about lines. And so I'll work through there, and then maybe, you know, there's a bunch of blank stares, and I'll say something that has to do with the way that lines are oriented, and then some hands will go up. But I'm trying to get where the things that they're learning are internalized to the level, and I'm just talking about grammar level material, that they can restate those things in their own words. And really, it's somewhat of a pro gym exercise where they're just restating things and putting in their own words. And Jonathan Edwards, if you ever study his biography, when you look at the way he actually taught himself a tremendous amount of material at a young age, one of the things he did was to carry a notebook around. And when he read and studied, he would write down in his own words the things that he had learned. And that internalizes the material, whether you restate it verbally or write it down. So what I'll do is I'll ask some open-ended questions. Tell me what you know about the Augustan history card. You know, where I'd already gone over it and they know the facts. And then all of a sudden, the first time they do that, they kind of sit there with a blank stare. Or if I say, if somebody came into our classroom today and asked one of you, tell me what you know about that card that you studied, what would you say? And you'll find that kids have a little bit of difficulty doing that, but we need in the 4th through 6th grade to try to get them to internalize it to such a degree that they can restate it just by their own knowledge. So I do that quite a bit. And I think about Jesus saying to his disciples, well, who's everybody saying that I am? Well, who do you say I am? Put it in your own words. State what you believe and what you understand about the Christ. So that's one thing I do with the review. It's interesting with the grammar that we use. And it's just kind of hitting me over the years that with all the chanting and all the sentence flow stuff, if I just say, tell me about an adjective, what do you know about an adjective? You know, it dies. There's nothing, unless we're just prompting, and that's telling me that we're not getting it to where it's internalized, where somebody can't give a definition of an adjective, give an example of an adjective. So I'm trying to do that. As I'm teaching the material, I'm teaching them how to learn. That's how Edwards learned. That's how classicists learn, so I think that's a good tool. The second thing, and this is maybe going to take a little bit of skill, but I call it imposing the dialectic in the grammar stage. And what I mean is not that we ask these very difficult logical questions that the kids are not quite ready for, but what dialectic is engaging the students with questions. It's being like a tutor to the kids, asking them questions, not necessarily answering all the questions, but just teaching them how to formulate questions. And you need to become a question master. When you're sitting down reading a book, start thinking, what can I ask them to facilitate them learning what I want them to learn? And what can I ask that'll just cause them to say, yeah, I have no idea. I never even thought about that question. And just kind of work with it and try to walk through. One of the things that happens in the grammar stage, we become overly dogmatic. That is, we take particulars and we just beat them into their brains. And what happens with this particular approach is you're trying to move the kids more to generals than the particulars. Because I call it, sometimes when I get over grammarized or whatever you want to call it, I sing this little song, swimming in a sea of particulars. And I just, I'm saying, all, it just seems like fact, 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 fact. All we're doing is just going over this stuff. So what you're trying to do is move to more general things when you're talking with the kids. Now, they have a little bit of difficulty with that. I'll give you an example. You may be looking at a historical figure, and you're looking at his name, where he lives, what he's done, some of the things that he said, and so forth, and they're memorizing that information. Well, teach them how to study a historical figure. Tell them, you know, if you studied any historical figure, this is what you would do. You'd ask when they were born, when they died, what they did, where they lived, what was their religion, what were some good things, what were some bad things, and teach them how to study that material. That's a generalized approach, and then you're looking at the particulars. So you're teaching them to think, to formulate questions. You're not necessarily giving them all the answers. I love when we get on some of these ethical questions. In some of the books we read in fourth grade, there's mention of guys drinking or getting drunk and so forth. And then we kind of have a mixed class in terms of views on that. And so I'll ask, now, what do you think about Christians drinking alcohol? I'll just throw that question out, and it's really interesting to see what kids. Now you may think, what in the world are you doing talking about that kind of stuff? And I'm just saying, well, it's in the book. They're asking the question as it is, and just say, what do you think? Now you're not going to go up there and try to dogmatize them on your view. And if it gets where things are, where you get in those areas that Christians may have differences, you're always going to defer to the parents. But you're teaching them how to walk through this. And someone says, well, I think it's wrong to drink. And you say, well, why is that? Because people get hurt because of drinking. Say, okay, well, people get hurt in automobiles. Should we legislate against automobiles? They'll kind of scratch their heads a little bit. And then, the next comment, you don't spend the whole day doing this, but you use those moments when you've gone through and you've moved through the year and you're teaching the kids how to think through some things, raising some of those questions, not necessarily dogmatizing. And remembering, again, in all of this, we're developing the verbal arts, teaching the kids how to think, memorizing the material that they need to, and then communicating that material in their own words.
The two tools that I picked for this, one of them is going on walks, and the other is playing, and those are my two favorites. Maybe for obvious reasons. But every Friday, the sixth graders go for a walk. We all go for a walk. And we can only go as far as we can recite James. And so we're trying to memorize the book of James. And we start at the very beginning of the year, and we sing it. And one thing I realized coming from third grade to sixth grade is I had all these preconceptions of what a sixth grader was like. And if you've taught lower elementary, the sixth graders they're big. You think they're the big kids. And then you go teach the sixth graders and you think, they're so small. But one of the things I thought was third graders love to sing, and I'd get my guitar out. And this was, if I wanted to teach anything really well so that we knew it, we would sing it. But I thought, I'm going to have to shed some of these things when I go to sixth grade because we're big up there and too mature for this sort of playing around. And one thing I realized right off the bat is I was profoundly mistaken. The sixth graders love to sing as much as the third graders, and there's an appropriate maturity I think that we should see in the quality of music and the things that we're singing about. And I run into roadblocks there because of my musical ability, but so we started singing the book of James, and you memorize your memory verse, all week long, and you sing it. And then on Friday, instead of just sitting there, and we did this for a few weeks, you sit there and recite, breathing on each other the whole time. I thought, we need to go for a walk, and we're gonna get out on the sidewalk in two straight lines next to each other, and we're gonna sing James down the street and see how far we can make it away from school. And as soon as we get done with what we have memorized, we're going to turn around and we're going to sing it on the way back. And so we started taking walks. And we'd walk, and we ended up making it about a mile and a half by the time we were done. So you go a mile and a half, and you've got all James done, and then you sing a mile and a half on the way home. And we got done with one walk, and I went into the office, and the secretary said, we just got a phone call from the from a little old lady up on the hill, and she said that there was a group of kids out there in the rain walking and singing strange songs. Oh, well, that was us. We were out there reciting James. But that so that's the first one, is singing. Singing is just a wonderful tool. It's one of those tools that works on me even, and so I know that it's effective. You know, I chanting is seems to work well for the young kids, but there are some things that I've outgrown, I think. Singing still is effective with Mr. Whitling, and so in order to keep up with the kids, we focus on those sorts of tools. The second one is playing, and what I mean by that is there's nothing like being Beowulf instead of just reading about him. So in other words, if you do a play, you know, and there's this formal category called drama, where you could take a book and turn it into a class play, and I think that's wonderful. But there are other things that you can do also, and one that we tried this year was a World War I reenactment. And so the sixth graders, we studied about Sergeant York, and many of you are probably familiar with Sergeant York. There's a movie out about him. But I decided, you know, that we're learning about poetic knowledge, and we want to teach more than just this data transfer sort of thing between heads. And I thought, what better than to learn about World War I and then go do a reenactment? And so we found this county park. It was 180 acres of wheat and rolling hills and some trees at the top of the hill. And the kids dressed up in camo, face paint, and guns, and everyone brought shovels. And we dug, you know, it's trench warfare in World War I. We dug trenches, and I split the class into Germans and Americans, and gave them an hour and a half to dig their trenches and set up their flags and secure their positions. And then we walked through the actual taking of Hill 223, where Sergeant York single-handedly almost captured this hill. And then we switched. When we were done, we switched so that everyone could be an American and a German. We traded our trenches and flags and so forth and did that. And it gave an understanding. You know, they were dirty. They knew what it was like to dig a trench and to shoot out of it and to try to go over the top in the midst of German machine gun nests up on the ridge. And it was something that I thought communicated some of the grassroots understanding of a lesson that could be pretty sterile if you didn't bring it home in that sort of way. So walking and playing are my two.
Okay, I just want to remind you, if you came in late and you have a question for the panel, just write on a little card or something and bring it on up to the table. I have three cards here. They all are related somewhat to discipline, so I'm going to ask Matt to cover this one, and then Martha and Scott, if you want to add something, you can. And I know you could talk for sessions and hours about these, Matt, but one of them is, could you please give us some strategies for keeping order and retaining excellent school culture on the playground? Pointers for staff regarding consistency in this unstructured time. And then another one is, how can you bring parents on board with discipline without parents feeling that you're nitpicky? And then, what do you think should happen when a child is sent to the principal's office if the school does not use corporal punishment? I know those are a little bit unrelated, but they all are on discipline. So discipline on the playground, parents, and sending somebody to the office.
Okay. One of the beauties of the playground is that it is unstructured. And oftentimes we can become afraid of that. You know, we think, well, it's not an organized activity. But really, one of the strong points of having your kids in a school is that they may get knocked over. And for your boys especially, that's what you want. And so, you know, for us as parents, it's not that we want to train our children so that they can function successfully in a militaristic situation where there's somebody over them monitoring them all the time. We want our children to be able to understand how to live faithfully before God when they've got a little free time, and within bounds, you know. And so we don't want mayhem out on the playground just to toughen up the boys, you know, really get them beat up a lot. But I do like the flexibility. I like the possibility for situations coming up that would end up at the dinner table in a discussion where my son says, "Well, Papa, what do I do if this kid just won't let me alone? You know, he wants to play basketball, and I'm trying to do something else, and he just keeps bugging me, and there's not a teacher there to iron it out." I think those sorts of practical situations that come up are a strength of recess and not a weakness of it. And so we should prepare the kids beforehand for temptations. Here's what's going to happen when you're out there. There may be a time when someone is too rough with one of your sisters, and she may just be a sister in Christ. There may be a girl that's in your second grade class who's being bugged by a fourth grade bully, and here's how you should respond. And these are the sorts of situations that wisdom comes out of, because you don't, there's not always one answer. It depends, well, how big is the guy? How big are you? Should that matter in what you're going to do? Well, absolutely. You want to protect her, and protecting her is a wisdom call. You don't just charge in and get clobbered. You may need to bring the reinforcements. You know, sometimes it's wise to go get the recess duty so that she can address it. Other times it's better to do something yourself and then go get the recess duty. And there are all sorts of interesting little pathways that you have to go down, because recess is there again tomorrow. If recess wasn't going to happen again, you could just say, well, these are tough issues, and it takes a lot of maturity to know how to handle yourself, son. And hopefully you'll get that, because evidently I don't have it. You know, I don't have anything to say to you on this particular point. But we all know that recess is coming back tomorrow, and we have to prepare our kids to do well out there. And I think just kind of in the generic realm, teachers need to know what the standards are, what's acceptable behavior out there. Can you, we have a very small playground nowadays, can you play hardball, baseball out there, or no? Is there an off-limits area? What do you do when a child violates one of the rules? How do you handle it? And those are all things that you can discuss and get down on paper and make sure that there's consistency in how rules are enforced and applied.
Okay, I'll say some for you. We do our recess a little bit different, and I have my famed kickball sermons. And I actually play with the kids, and we have the 4th through 6th graders out, and just with our facility and so forth, we really need to be out there. I mean, we kind of just look at some things a little bit differently, but we have what I call the PKL, the Professional Kickball League. The beauty of kickball is it's accessible to every child. And I really look at recess as a training ground. And last year I had a bunch of boys who were in competitive sports, and they had a rough time differentiating between playing soccer out in a competitive league, which I basically say to them, win at all costs, but honor Christ. And don't, you know, I'm like, the goal is to win in a competitive sport. It's not to say, well, we're all winners and everybody's good. And, you know, I don't like that, because I'm so anti-egalitarian. So, but there's a difference when you're playing. And I say, you know, at school it's a family culture, and so I try to get them to look differently. But we've added these strategic moves to the kickball game that are almost chess-like in nature and really sort of challenge the kids. And it's amazing, because all they want to do is play kickball the whole year. They love it. And there are so many teaching opportunities that I find out on the kickball field. We have the 4th, 5th, and 6th grade teachers are all men, so we're out there really teaching them a lot of things. And some of the boys who start slamming other kids when they mess up and things like that, we have great opportunities to teach them of what a family sport is like, and how to honor one another, how to have fun, to do well. And then I always take a good slam at egalitarianism and all this, you know, we should have won kind of stuff and all that. And it's amazing how much teaching goes on in the kickball field. But we did kind of struggle with the order and the recess thing. And I guess as a parent, the way our setup was, it was so chaotic. Really, I mean, there were a lot of injuries out there. And I used to kid with parents that came in to kind of fill in once in a while and say, well, here's the first aid kit. and you know, here's the ice packs, and just say, I say all the time, you're okay, and I have a high pain tolerance, so you know, that's the way it works. And then I'm usually heaving basketballs from mid-court, slamming some kids anyway. So, I mean, it was just kind of wild, you know. So this has worked really well on the playground. Maybe just to address one idea on the parents with the discipline, we feel really blessed at our school because most of the parents are really on board. And I find that most of the times when I have a discipline problem with a student, I sort of have to lessen it because, as a parent, when you hear that your child did something wrong at school, if you're really a proactive parent, I mean, you're going to know that the teacher's probably having a difficult time telling you really how bad the situation was. And so they just kind of assume that the parent is having a difficult time saying, you know, well, he did this, and they sort of interpolate and add, you know, an exponential factor to the seriousness of what was done. And, you know, I'm like, you know, it's really, they're okay, they're responding to my discipline. You know, it's like, don't go home and just slam them because, you know, I'm just like, I'm letting you know. And most of the time it's taken care of. But I find that I don't really have, you know, most of them are on board with that. And I try, we don't have corporal discipline in school. And I just keep thinking that, you know, discipline is supposed to be a grief. It's supposed to be a grievous thing, Hebrews 12. And I don't know that we're hitting it there. I know in my home, when my kids violate something and they're disciplined, I think always there's a register there. This is grievous. When I sin and I'm held accountable for it, it's a grievous thing. And I tried, you know, try to help the parents maybe think about some of that stuff. Because I do have situations where maybe the parents are just not on board with that, and I'll have the same problems the entire year. And that can be really frustrating as a teacher. But I'd have to say that's kind of more the small minority.
About the playground, I don't have much to add, but I just wanted to say, you know, some of us may still be in school situations where we don't have much of a playground. Ours is a parking lot right now, and probably will stay a parking lot for a while. And therefore, sometimes we forget that there's not a lot to do in a parking lot. So I think that remembering that and then bringing out things that are portable, like jump ropes and soccer balls and even the old-fashioned marbles and jacks, those kinds of things are helpful to keep minds and hands and bodies busy, and they can do things that are going to burn off some of that energy. So.
Okay, thank you. Here's a question. Any suggestions for scripts for third through fifth grade plays? And panel, you're welcome to each talk about each subject. Don't feel like you have to say something about each one. Maybe one person can handle it. Anybody want to tackle this one? Scripts for third through fifth grade plays.
Yeah, what we usually do is we have to put on two plays a year per grade for the rest of the students in the elementary. And oftentimes, we teachers find ourselves taking an original play, you know, Shakespearean play, or taking a book and writing our own play from it. And it is much easier to take something that's established and pare it down than to try to come up with some plot that you're gonna cook up and have it really go over well. Also, if you have your kids do a play, it is very, very time consuming. To do anything that's worthwhile is going to take, you know, a couple weeks, 3 weeks of pretty diligent practice on your part and organization, knowing how it's going to work and getting the stage set up and if you're going to do props and that sort of thing. So whatever you choose to do your play on, it should be really worthwhile because they're memorizing it, they're living it, they're going to perform it, they're going to teach it to the rest of the elementary. Anything that you choose should be something that if you think, all right, this is going to be, we're going to devote hours and hours of time to this. It should be worth it. Okay, it's got to be something that's worth all the time. So we generally will cook something up, reduce some original work into a play that's appropriate. And I don't have a good resource, you know, that has 50 plays you could choose from on the internet or something. I'm sure there are some sorts of things out there. We need help in this area. What I did one year, one of the parents wrote a play, and I gave them some material. It was on the life of Augustine.
there are just not a lot of materials, but we need to do a lot more drama. I love the idea of the two plays a year, but just the time that's involved there is tremendous. And then when you don't really feel comfortable with some of the scripts that are available with the typical resources, and we need to create stuff. So I just keep thinking, if I get one of these every couple of years over time, I can use it again on another year. But I think, we definitely need some people trying to do that, because it's really worthwhile. I have a question for you, Matt. Did you do Beowulf with your kids in third grade? Could you tell us how you did that?
I took a translation by a guy named Dr. Spaeth. I think I really like it. It's wonderful. And just, it was on the internet, it's copyright free, and I pared it down. We didn't go the whole distance. We stopped. Grendel. I think we went into Grendel's mother's cave. I forget. We did it in sixth grade also and did it differently. But we didn't do the dragon. We didn't do anything with the dragon. And the kids memorized the poetry. There are different bits that went out, and I think it was 12 to 20 lines per kid. And my plays are all pretty simple. I like to take a work of literature and shorten it, but have it be the real thing, because I know that anything Whitling writes is going to be far inferior to the real deal. So we end up with little people to come up and explain what in the world we're doing up there on the stage. I'll end up with a narrator who talks at the beginning, and then he'll tell the kids what to look for in the next scene, and sometimes review what they just saw and where they're going with the plot. One thing that we've done this past year is, instead of exhausting teachers by saying, you've got two plays a year until you're dead, and if you've written plays, sometimes you get this idea and you think, oh, this is great, this is going to be a real hopper, and you're excited and you can cook it up and make it go, and other times you think, what book am I going to use? These books won't, what history am I going to do? And you just don't have a good idea. So you start a play and throw it away, and you start another play. What we've decided to do in the elementary is each grade needs six plays. That's our goal, is to get six plays done. And as an administrator now, I'm seeing things through different eyes. I approve six plays for each grade, and then we cycle through them, okay, two plays a year. So every 3 years, we redo the plays. And a couple reasons for that. One is, if it's a good play, there should be no embarrassment over redoing it. Okay, it's been 3 years later, kids haven't seen it that recently, and that way you hone that play, and it gets better and better every time you perform it. And then there's this impetus from the teacher's perspective to make it good, because it's not disposable anymore. It used to be a play for a day, and then you pitch it. You've used that idea. There's no sense in putting it on the computer. We're just going to throw it away. But now you hone it, and you revise it, and you learn from it, and then you know this is coming around in a few years, and you want this to really go, and you start saving props, and you know how to anticipate these sorts of things. The other advantage is that as an administrator, I know that there are six good plays ready to be put on for each grade, and a teacher can submit a different play. Mr. Cole, our fifth grade teacher, he's doing all these Greek plays that he wants to sell eventually. I think he has 15 Greek mythology plays that he's written up. And so he always wants to do new ones. Well, if he submits a new one, I can look at it, and if I don't think it's better than the one we've got in the slot, I can just say, no, let's stay with what we've got. And then we're not left hanging. But if a teacher spends hours and hours up late at night, and it's 2 weeks before her play is going to be put on, and she submits a script to me, well, what am I going to tell her? No, this is a dumb idea. You have to scrap the whole thing and start over again. There needs to be some kind of backup plan, so that if it didn't really take, if it's not going to fly, we've got this great play waiting in the wings that we can bring right out and put on.
Okay, next question. Do you have all of your subjects every day, or are some alternated?
The way that we teach subjects at Mars Hill, we have certain subjects that we offer fewer days of the week than all five. Math, of course, would be all 5 days of the week, as well as English composition and grammar. Literature is unfortunately not offered every day of the week. Science is offered 3 days of the week in the grammar school. So we alternate, and it really is a matter of us deciding what are the classes that we feel that we need to ground the students in and at what year. Of course, as we move through the grammar school, some of those classes become 5 days a week.
They have art once a week with an art teacher for 30 minutes, and then I usually give them an extra 10 or 15 just to finish up what they're working on. We started this year music classes 2 times a week for 30 minutes, and we're kind of working on a K through 12 music curriculum, which is really exciting, just trying to think long term on how we're going to do the music. Then they have science once a week for 45 minutes. And then the rest of the time, I'm there, and I do math for about an hour to hour, 15 minutes, and I do them every day, every subject every day. History for about 30 minutes, Latin for 20 to 30, literature for an hour, Shirley grammar 25 to 35 minutes, pro gym is usually 15 to 20, spelling's probably 20 minutes, and then Bible and catechism takes, I go over catechism every day, which is a lot of work with memory, and then I read through an Old Testament section and spend 3 days a week for about 30 to 40 minutes on that. So pretty much everything.
Ours is similar. There are some subjects that we do every day and others that alternate.
Okay, these two are somewhat similar. If you're just starting a school and with a child who is going into the sixth grade, or if a child comes in from a government school from the sixth grade, where do you start in the grammar stage? Do you back up to an earlier grade level and start and bring them on up, or do you just kind of jump right in? And then along with that, I know in our school, and I think in Logos too, in our fourth grade class, we use Saxon Math 54. We are a year advanced in each math. But this question is there a lesson number that is recommended to start the school year or try to finish the school year? So we have students coming in at different levels. How do you jump them into classical Christian education?
We give all of the students in first through sixth grade, any incoming students, an entrance exam, and it has a literature component and a math component and an English component where they do some writing and they work through some grammar. And that gives us a ballpark figure as to where they should end up, you know, which grade they should be in. So there's not a, it depends on the student. There are some students that can come in sixth grade and they've never had Latin before, and they can take summer school to get ready for it, work really hard during the year, come in at lunchtime and talk to Julie Garfield about assignments, and they can make it. They can do well. There are other students who will have to audit, end up auditing Latin for their first year, and then they hit the books for the next summer. And so we're willing to work with them up to a point. But the entrance exam, I think, is a must. We went for years and years without any sort of formal exam, and it was just a bad deal for kids and bad deal for parents, because what you end up with is, you know, halfway through the first quarter, everybody realizes that this boat's not going to float, and you're still reviewing stuff from last year. You're not even into the new material yet. And all of a sudden, parents are faced with this dilemma of, what are we going to do? Now, do we put them back into the grade before? Do we just pull them out? And oftentimes, that's the easiest thing. We're just going to pull them out. So I think as much as you can do beforehand to establish what playing field should this child be in when it comes to the most important foundational subjects is a blessing to kids and is a blessing to parents and to teachers too. You know how frustrating it is to have a little one in there that's just not able to keep up. Oh, Saxon math. We have our own second grade math program that BJ Jordan has written. She's working on a third grade. And part of the reason, we think we could do the jump. We could go a year ahead and we could make that work. It would take a little more time out of our schedule. And so we've opted not to do that at this point. We are, we do the 7-6 book in sixth grade, and there really isn't that much difference, I don't think, between the 7-6 and the 8-7. You know, there are a lot of similarities between those. But at this point, we've opted not to take time from other subjects in order to get that year ahead. We've stayed on track, but usually about the first quarter of the year, we do double lessons. So in sixth grade, we'll teach lesson one, teach lesson two. The kids do the practices from both and the problem set from two. And so you do day two, you do three and four, five and six. And that keeps the monotony down because kids are juggling two lessons and they review anyway. Everybody's seen them for years and years, so it's nothing spectacular. But it keeps you on your toes a little bit more. And it cuts down on what I think is wasted time. I believe that Saxon math is designed to have students come in and not have paid attention for years and years. And if they pay attention that year, they can be successful. Now, there are advantages to that, especially if you teach in the government school. But you don't want to look at your sixth grade teacher and say, you know, these kids have been in your school for 4 years already, but that really doesn't matter. All that stuff they did before, they could pick it up this year because you'll teach them every concept they've learned down the line already. We'd like to see the standards be such that the year in third grade was worth something. The year in fourth grade was worth something. Another disadvantage of just going lockstep and doing the lessons the way they say is it positively puts to sleep the teacher and positively puts to sleep the students. Because here's what happens. I remember as a first-year teacher teaching third grade, and this is not very high up in the line, you know, just third grade, I started teaching math and I thought, oh, this is fun. I'm going to be teaching new concepts. And you know, part of the beauty of teaching is seeing kids learn something new. Well, the first quarter went by, there was nothing new. Second quarter went by, there was nothing new. My disposition as a teacher became, we know this stuff. And the kids thought the same thing. We learned this stuff in second grade, Mr. Whitling. And so I became lazy and lax, and I thought, hey, I'm teaching this thing in 30 seconds. We're going to get this done and get on to something that's more interesting. And the kids thought the same thing. We really don't need to work hard or pay attention. We know it all. And then all of a sudden, you get three quarters of the way through the book, and they shift gears. And everybody has whiplash. And you think, everyone failed the test. I thought you kids knew this stuff. And the kids are thinking, we all thought we knew this stuff. And they actually introduced a new concept for once. And nobody realized it. That's the scary thing. You know, the kids didn't get it and didn't realize it. Teachers didn't realize they had to teach anything. And I just think the overall effect on the classroom, it was bad news. It was just too much review.
Scott, you might tackle this one. Somebody wants to know if they can get some more Pro Gym workshop handouts. And then, but the second part of that is, can you speak more about what types of writings work at different grade levels?
Yeah, Pro Gym stuff. I've got some notebooks of stuff that I got off the internet and just kind of been, it's sort of like this underground thing, you know, like digging this stuff up. If you want to get any of the materials that I had, I'd be happy to email them to you. I've got them, all the files. If you're talking about worksheets that I had, I intentionally didn't make copies of all the stuff. I've done this before in a smaller conference, and I had copies for everybody and just made them available for people that wanted them. And I was kind of hoping this time, and maybe I was a little bit overwhelmed with the numbers that I knew were going to be here. I'm saying, gee, 140 copies. Yeah, that's a big difference in making, you know, 10 copies of material. If you want them to see me, I'd be glad to send them to you. You can use it. And I was hoping maybe you would kind of be encouraged to make up some of your own. But I noticed having something to work from is helpful. So Bull and the Fairy Tale, they can cover that stuff pretty well through fourth grade. I try to introduce the next stage. I didn't get to get into that this morning. I was just trying to deal with the people that were newly exposed to this. And if you go back to your classroom, whether you're a second grade teacher or a sixth grade teacher, and you start getting the kids retelling fables and fairy tales, that's a successful thing. But I didn't get into the proverb and the anecdote, but I think they can start to do that towards the end of the year. And I didn't go through the steps, but it takes a little bit more logic with some of the proverbs, where they're actually given a proverb, and they praise the author, they restate the proverb, they maybe give a comparison or a contrast to the proverb, and then they illustrate the proverb, perhaps using a fable or a story, and then make an application of it. That's kind of heavy duty. You know, that's a lot of thought for a fourth grader. I definitely think they can handle that at the end of the year if there has been some background in pro-gym. Now, as our school starts to do more of it, I find the first week of school when I start doing fables and fairy tales, they're ready to go, where before I had to spend almost a half a year just to get them where they could just start retelling some of these things and get real excited about it. I definitely think through sixth grade they can start to get into some of the more advanced levels with comparison and contrast, and then the invective and the vituperation, where you can start to... And basically, if they're restating material in their own words, you're covering the broad scope of pro-gym, and then you're just fine-tuning with these different tools to make arguments more interesting and persuasive. So Matt has taught sixth grade. He may, you know, with a little more experience. I know at Westminster, you know, they kind of got through some of the basics about halfway through the step ladder of the pro-gym stuff. I mean, they're not going to be able to do theses and, you know, forensic rhetoric and all that kind of stuff. And interesting enough, I don't know if I said that, but I talked to the senior rhetoric teacher, and he said they still have the guys at senior level rhetoric tackling fables. I mean, just 1 week he'll come in and just have them retell a fable, and it's like the musician practicing the scales again and again, where they still have to do that. These are the tools that fit all together. So I hope that helped or answered that question.
Okay, here's a question. I just have one more question, so if we have any more questions out there, feel free to bring them up. How do you read through 10 books in the course of a year, and how much home reading do you expect?
10 books is pretty easy to get through in a year. I shoot for somewhere between 13 and 15 over the course of the year, and we have an hour a day that's devoted to literature, and the reading ranges from probably 10 pages a day to 30 pages a day, depending on the book that we're in and the font size. If it's a Dover Press book, they cram in a lot of words on one page, and you just can't get through as many, but you've got a thinner book also. All of my books are not huge. In sixth grade, you know, one's A Christmas Carol, and that you zip through that in a week very easily. We do Hamlet is a week, Much Ado is a week. So some of these books you can get through them in a week. Others are longer. We've done, in the past, we've done Tales of Two Cities, Watership Down, The Hobbit. Those sorts of books take a few weeks to get through. But I do not spend the majority of my time discussing and analyzing. I spend the majority of my time at my desk reading. And that way they can do the same. I think one of the skills that we want to develop in our students is the ability for them to read and love a book. And I think the discussion is important, but there is such a way to overkill on the worksheets and on the fill in the blanks and define 30 words in this chapter, and positively kills the love of reading.
So it's a balance, and it's good to have standards, because then that drives the tone of your program. If everybody knows we've got to make it through 10 books before the end of the year, that necessarily strips down some of the extras that you're going to do.
So how do you hold them accountable? How do you know they're reading those books?
With almost all of our books, especially the longer books, the rule is I give the kids a reading log, and they know when the book is due. And this is one of those things that would be different if it was in a lower grade where they don't manage their time as much the younger they are. But I want them to look and see a long-range goal, and then we work backwards and figure out, okay, that means I'm going to have to read this many pages per day to get this thing finished in the correct amount of time. And the rules of the game are there can be a pop quiz at any point down the road. So it's very clear to me. I know that everyone needs to be done with Chapter 7 by Wednesday, and I can schedule a quiz for Wednesday that would cover Chapters 1 through 7. And all I do, I'm the type, I have to read through the book with the kids. I cannot rely upon last year's reading. I just, it comes and goes, and I like seeing the details. And if you're not living the book with your classroom, you just don't get it. You have to, I think, and unless you're just brilliant, you have to be living in that world in order to see the connections in science so that you can make a literary allusion and have everybody get it. And that's one of the lovely things about reading through one book with the whole class. In third grade, I started out and I had 7 of these books, 5 of those books, 3 of these books, and you could make it work in groups if you had groups. But once you break down into groups, then you've lost your community. You cannot make the connections with history and science and grammar. You can't use those sentences from that book anymore because everybody's in a different world. Everybody's thinking about different characters. Whereas I think literature is the sort of subject that should drive the day. It's the sort of thing that you should be talking about what happened in literature at the beginning of the day and middle of the day and the end of the day. And so everyone has to be on the same page at the same time. And then I just give pop quizzes. And the majority of my pop quizzes I've just written up. I just read through and I think, okay, what are reasonable pieces of information or reasonable storyline, character sorts of questions that a sixth grader would remember if they read this thing with their eyes open, if they paid attention to what was going on. I also allow students to take notes, and sometimes I'll let them use their notes on the quiz. And that just guarantees, for me, I know that they're paying attention, they're jotting things down, and they're able to track with what's going on. If there's a movie that's made about the book, then the majority of your quiz questions have to come from the difference between the book and the movie. Although movies kind of kill books after a while.
Is most of this reading in class silent reading?
By sixth grade, the majority of the reading is silent reading. Probably 80% is silent reading. 20% is out loud. And it's the opposite. Younger in the elementary, almost all the reading is done out loud and very little silent reading. And then you see a switch, a progression through the elementary.
Okay, last question. And you can touch on this too because it's going to cover this a little bit. And then someone just gave me a question on Latin in the classroom. And we'll be up here for a few minutes. I know our time is up and I don't want to keep you here, so we'll end with this question. But if you do have a question that you'd like to come up, and we'll stay around here for a few minutes afterwards. But let's just kind of end today. We haven't mentioned the word homework much, so let's talk about homework. Homework in reading. Do you have some of this reading done in at home? How much homework should a third grader do? How much homework should a sixth grader do? Give us your thoughts on the amount of homework. Martha, we'll start with you and work back.
I'm going to talk mostly from a science perspective because I don't teach a grade, but we really try to give very little homework in science, which I know would seem unusual. I use my science statements, and I ask the children to really go home and very often say those to their parents. And that might take 5 minutes, 5 or 10 minutes. But we really like to get the majority of our work done in class. And that's pretty much all the way through the grammar school, even when we do the science fair, except for the experimenting that can't go on at school. That work goes on in school, in the classroom. So,
our school has a policy for the fourth grade. It should be 45 minutes max per night for a B student around there. So that's our range. My own philosophy or approach is I try to get everything done in school. And I'd have to say that I'm pretty successful. If I took a poll, and I regularly do poll kids and parents, that 80% of my class, my kids say they don't have any homework, they don't study, and they learn more than they ever have. But you have to work at a teacher. I mean, you think about it. These kids are 9, 10, 11 years old. They don't need to go to school hoof it to school, commute to school, and then do this 8 to 3 thing, and then go home, have a snack, and then do 4 hours of homework. I mean, and we're trying to inspire a love of learning. Now, you are going to have some kids where they're going to have to put the extra time. Newer students, slow students. Classrooms are really geared for kids that do the best are auditory kids who just soak things in through the ear gate. And if you're a teacher that combines auditory stimulus with visual stimuli, you should have a pretty good shot at hitting it with the kids. Some of the more kinesthetic learners, kids that are just kind of slow, just slow processors, it's going to be a lot more than that. But I do all my reading in the fourth grade out loud as a class. As we move through the year, they will get some silent reading. And I told you, if you were here earlier for the Pro Gym, they do chapter summaries. So typically what we do in literature, and I guess just to touch on that because I was kind of chomping at the bits for it, for the literature, and it's just really helpful because I agree with what Matt said. When you're in there in doing literature, you're really hitting at what the classical education is. The other things are just reinforcing, getting in there and going through material and then thinking like a Christian as you work through it. But what I do is the vocabulary words that the kids have come from the books that we study, and I usually give them the vocabulary before they get to the book. And then I tie and I associate the vocabulary words, which are words that are either going to have Latin roots or useful words. You know, you don't find some sort of culturally limited word and stick that on a vocabulary test and they'll use it one time, never to see it again. I mean, those are words that you have to write in your book to remember year by year what they mean. You know, don't pick those words. Pick the words that are useful words, Latin roots and so forth. Tie them to the story. I even pull most of my poetry now out of the books that I read. For example, like we do Ralph and the Viking Bow, and there's all this Scandinavian poetry in there. And I inspire my kids to be aggressive, kingdom-centered Christians who are warrior poets. And so I take that stuff and I run with it, and they love it. And I pull all of that out of the books. And then, so we spend some time, I review the vocabulary every day, we talk about it, we bring it to life, we recite the poetry, we love the way it feels on our lips and sounds to our ears and beating out rhythms, we do that. And then we read through the book, and that's where I do the dialectic stuff. And I just move through the class, and you have to model good reading with younger students. And I actually find one of the things that hinders upper school students is too much silent reading when they're young. And this is interesting because when I start letting the kids read a chapter by themselves, most of the time my kids who are my worst readers finish first. Because what I'll do is I'll say, okay, I want you to read chapter 13 and then do your summary and then you're finished. And then I'll go and I'll start reading it right when they do. And I'll look over and I'll see the book closed down and the handwriting and I'll come over. And what happens is their eyes are undisciplined. And so when they're reading out loud, they're skipping to the next cluster of words and they're stumbling. And you can tell they don't really understand what they're reading. And it's a lot because of too much silent reading when they're young. So get them reading out loud, and when I have a situation like that, I tell the parents, read out loud at home. Sit with a copy of the book, let them read a paragraph, you read a paragraph, and just go back and forth. And you model reading. Sometimes I'll have them read a paragraph, then I read one, next student, then me. And I'm modeling good reading with expression and enthusiasm and all that. And then sometimes I'll just have them go in a sequence. And this year was great because we'd get where they'd go paragraph or sentence, and it would flow. It'd sound like a play. Kids reading with expression, smooth, just going through all that. So we read through, we talk about it, and then they summarize in their own words in their little literature notebook. and they keep track of all the characters that we come up with. And so they love it. They've got this little pattern for every book. We keep track of the characters. We do vocabulary, poetry, and then we write our little summaries. And then when it comes time for the book report, they do exactly the same thing because you modeled it for them. So try to not have homework. That's one of the things I do with the reading. Just try to get as much as you can. And I always give my kids time to do written homework. I can't think of maybe one or two situations where, I taught them something about grammar, and then I said, okay, do page 59 tonight. Let's go to spelling. I always give them time, and then I'm walking around the classroom seeing what they're doing. And if you really utilize your time and move through your subjects, they should be able to get most of it done. Like I said, 80% usually do that.
For homework, we're similar. In third grade, my max was 30 minutes a night. I was shooting for 30 minutes a night. In sixth grade, it's 45 to 60 minutes per night. And if you love what you're teaching and you're learning new things, it is very easy to overload a class because you think, oh, and then there's this, and then there's this, and we've got to get them doing this, and you've pretty soon you've buried them. So it's important to monitor how much is going out. And this was mentioned before, you know, taking surveys, asking parents, how's the homework going? It is important that you ask the right parents also, because you need to consider the source. Who is it that's telling me this? What's their student like? How does he use his time in the classroom? And so you should weight comments differently depending on who gives them to you. The one thing we're looking at for next year is establishing, you know, it's easy to say, well, I've got 60 minutes and I'm generally shooting for about 60 minutes a night or less. It's another thing to say, all right, let's break those 60 minutes down. And for your average student, what does that mean? Does it mean 15 minutes on spelling a night and 15 minutes on Latin a night? And how much time is left over once the pie has been divvied up? And then we're going to, at back to school night, give the parents a recommended amount of time for their students to spend on each subject. Because oftentimes our parents aren't or haven't been good students. They don't know that if you've got a test in 2 weeks, that means you should start studying now a little bit every night. You know, and it's easy. We're educators. We think about this. We know about that procrastination word, and we know you're not supposed to stay up late the night before the test. But parents are busy people, and this is not a, sometimes they don't get some of the simplest things. And so in a gracious, loving way, we should sit down and say, look, here's what we're shooting for, and here's a recommended schedule that you could follow every night in order to have your child up to speed on longer-term assignments. Here's a ballpark figure. Spend 15 minutes a night on spelling. And if your child has it all down, then you can discontinue that and buys you more time. But homework really is an issue that is important. It's important that we don't run over parents' family time. But it's also important that students learn to work hard and be diligent and to plan ahead and study ahead until the balance is worth the time.
Well, thank you very much, panel. I want to get your names on the tape here. They're taping this, so in case anybody has a question, I want to thank Martha Ryan from Mars Hill right here, and Scott Smith from Westminster, and Matt Whitling from Logos School, and I'm Tom Eddy from Whitfield Academy. I know the general membership meeting is ready to start right now, so you're excused for that. Thank you for coming, and we'll stay up here for a little bit if you'd like to come and talk to us.